On translations and translating, and we left off last time talking about some of the difficulties involved in translating the Bible, translating really from any language to another language, and what the best means of trying to get that accomplished is. And I don't want to go back through all of these again, but just to kind of get you back to where we were when we left off, we were talking about what translators have to do with things like euphemisms and weights and money and measure and gender accuracy and all of those kinds of things when we left off. And I really want to kind of transition into some translation principles that I think are kind of fundamental of what you're really looking for, because at this point we're really getting to the practical output of this entire study, which is, what do I do with all of this information that we've been talking about? How do I go about choosing a translation? What is the best translation for me to use? Is there a single best translation, or is it maybe kind of case by case, depending on the individual, depending on the situation even? And we'll talk about some translation principles and some kind of guidelines for evaluating translations. I'd hoped initially when I started this class to be able to kind of go through and look at translations specifically and note some of the pros and cons of each. We're just not going to have the time to do that. And so I'll give you the basic principles and leave that in your capable hands to do with as you will. And starting next week in this class will be a study of the afterlife, heaven and hell, and things of that nature. And I presume that's when the class in the back will be starting as well, on a different subject next Sunday. So that kind of gives you an idea of where we've been and where we're going. So with that in mind, what are some basic translation principles? What are you looking for in a good translation? With the background, again, of all of the things that we've talked about up to this point in this class, what is fundamental to finding a good translation? Before I put up what I've got on the screen, what would come to your mind, especially if you've been here the whole time, but even if not, what would you think of as something that's important for you in finding a good translation? Okay. That's not bad. Accuracy of the original text. Number one on the list. What's number two? No.
I'll leave that for somebody.
Well, this is important, because when you are translating from one language to another, what you want is an accurate representation of what the original said. And if what you wind up with is not an accurate representation of what the original said, then obviously it's not a good translation. There's a certain amount of common sense involved in, you want a translation that is accurate to the original text. Now, again, when we've talked about the difference in formal equivalence and functional equivalence in translation theory, there is some debate as to which can be most accurate. Is it necessarily accurate to translate everything literally in a word-for-word basis? Well, generally speaking, I think it is. But there are times where you lose the meaning when you translate literally, if it is an idiom where the meaning of the phrase isn't really the sum of the parts of the phrase. If you translated literally, "it's raining cats and dogs," into another language, that would not mean in that language what we mean when we say that. And so there's more to accuracy to the original text than just finding literal corresponding words to the original language words. And that's not just in that kind of specific idiom, but other things as well. Just the way that people think about things. We talked about the different way that heart is used, where in the Bible the heart is the mind in the way that we would think of it. We think of it as an emotional center. They thought of it as a thought center. They placed the emotional center a little further south in their way of thinking. But so what? How do you accurately represent? Well, you have to wrestle with those kinds of issues. But obviously, however you determine what the best way to handle those things are, what you want is something that's accurate to the original text. But it's again, it's more than just being as literal as possible in the translation. What else do you think? I don't want to just go on forgetting that I'd opened the discussion. Anything else? Readability? Who said that? Dan, is that you? Yeah, and that's that's obviously important as well. And in particular, this is the kind of thing that might be more weighty on a case-by-case kind of basis. There are some people for whom readability is more important than other people. We went to the Belmont Heights congregation for a long time when we lived in Tampa, and there was a brother there who had gone to school through third grade, and when he got his stuff ready to go to fourth grade, his mom said, "Where are you going? We need help here at the house." And he turned around and came back, and that was the end of his school career. For him, the New American Standard Bible is probably not the best translation. He read from an old King James, and I'm not entirely sure how much he would get out of it when he read from it. But he was a man who was devoted to the Word and devoted to the Lord. But that's the kind of person that probably needs one of the Bibles that is more targeted to a lower reading level to be understandable than other people. And that's going to depend some on where you fall on that spectrum of being able to read something and comprehend it. So there's a time and a place for something like the NIV, which is written at a much lower reading level. There are people that need that kind of translation to be able to grasp anything from the Bible. Now, as a whole, I think that, being more accurate is more important than being more readable. But at the same time, if it's translated in such a way that no one understands it, then it's not useful as a translation. Well, since I'll go ahead and put the next one up as well, because it kind of goes with what we were talking about a second ago, which is fidelity to the original words. Again, there's a time and a place where you have to depart from the original words in order to make sense of a translation. You can't just be literal all the time. But as a rule, I would argue that you want to be faithful to the original words as much as you can, except for when you have to change them in order to make the meaning clear. And the point that I made before, at least once, if not 500 times, is that when an author uses a word, and you find Paul doing this repeatedly, he'll use the same word repeatedly in a sentence or in a context, and it's clear that Paul's trying to make a point by using that word repeatedly. When you find a translation that's just trying to make good English, well, you don't use the same word over and over and over in good English. You find synonyms because, like your writing teachers have told you, no one wants to hear you say, justification 15 times in the same sentence. So you find other ways of saying that. Well, that's not what Paul did. And Paul was doing that to make a point about that. Otherwise, either that or Paul had a very small vocabulary, which I'm pretty sure isn't the case. So when you translate it, you don't want to use every synonym possible or you lose something of the impact of that. And that's just one example of where it's important to be faithful to the original words rather than trying to make good-sounding English out of it. Greg? Accuracy to the original text. Yeah, I probably should have made that say accuracy of the original text. There's really not that much of a difference. So I would, probably to distinguish them, I'd say accuracy of the original text. That is the underlying Greek text of the New Testament, and that goes back to the issues that we talked about regarding Erasmus' rush to print as opposed to the more modern text that has better, older manuscripts. Yeah, Brother Wynn?
I was reading the foreword of a New English translation last night, and they said they wanted to have a completely new translation, but there were so many errors, they went back to the best ones, and they picked a few best and used that as a basis of their new translation.
Yeah, that's an interesting... The whole issue of the Greek manuscripts for the New Testament is... really an interesting one in itself. What's the best way to reflect, how do you determine what the original authors wrote since we don't have any of the originals? Well, as we've said, even if you choose the worst ones by design, you still have the message hasn't changed. The message of the Bible hasn't changed. On the one hand, it's not that big of a deal. On the other hand, there are improvements that have been made with discoveries over the years. And so what do you do? Do you just, have... what the most texts say this, so you go with the majority reading? Do you say, well, the oldest texts say this, so you go with the oldest reading? Do you try to mix and match and determine what you think is the best reading? Do you choose one manuscript and go with what that manuscript says? I mean, there are all kinds of ways that people have grappled with that issue. So that's a whole class in itself. We won't get into all of that. But it's a difficulty that the translators have to wrestle with.
Tom? I think just the practical lesson from that is, on the one hand, you want to have the best tool you can get for the job. You know, any of them are good enough, but some are better than others. And so, you know, if you have the opportunity to have a better tool, why not use it? The other side of that is, if you do compare translations and you see, for example, in 1 John 5, you know, mine has a verse missing and this one has something additional, not to get too excited about that because it's really a minor difference. And certainly don't go out on a limb and build some huge theological doctrine based on this one questionable passage, whether it belongs in or whether it doesn't. Just say, well, it's not that important. Don't get excited. That was...
Right. Well, I won't. Shane?
I think one of the things that I, you know, struggle with when going back and forth between what's the, you know, and I always get confused between functional equivalence and the other one. But as far as trying to write a translation that, you know, it seems like by the time you would get a translation that was written in today's vernacular, if you wanted to have something that was a little more modern, you know, it seemed like by the time you got that thing written and produced, that probably vernacular has changed to the point that, you know, it still wouldn't even make sense. I mean, just a few years ago, I had a young man that I was training at a place that I work, and he was talking about, you know, a car or something that he saw, and he said, "Man, that thing was sick." And I thought he was criticizing it at first. And then I realized as he continued to talk how much he liked it, and sick was now, you know, a complimentary term that he was using. So, you know, stuff like that. It's like when you think just how quickly a word, you know, changes in the model, you know, how difficult it would be to be a little more. So I think probably I lean towards, you know, something that's more accurate to the original language, and then, you know, you try to figure it out for yourself based on what it meant back then as opposed to what our language means.
Yeah, and there's obviously something of a difference between trying to make it read in an up-to-date 21st century sort of way as opposed to trying to make it match the specific cultural vernacular where you would, you know, use words like sick or tight or cool or bad or awesome or whatever else it may be in that, you know, 5-year window. And that's the kind of thing that really, that kind of slang really dates out in a hurry. I think there may be a point where you can make it more functional without embracing all of that. But I think you're right. The nature of language changed. And we talked about that some in regard to like weights and measures and stuff. That's not the kind of thing you want to use modern terminology specifically to measure. You know, you're talking about money. What is, you know, 30 pieces of silver? Well, you put a dollar amount on what 30 pieces of silver is right now. In 20 years, it's going to be a worthless number. And so that kind of thing, especially, you don't want to do that with. Anything else? Well, the next point gets to what Daniel was talking about: clarity, understandability, readability. You want words and connotations and vivid expressions. You want things that are clear to the point. You don't want to be confusing. You don't want a translation that's confusing and muddies the water by the way it translates things. I'll let me move on so we have time to talk about some more stuff. You want to preserve the ambiguity. This is, I think, one of the more important points that I like to come back to. And that is when you're reading the Bible, very often it's not clear exactly what it means. Now, you could say, well, I want clarity, and you pick something that it could mean and translate it that way. But if the Bible is ambiguous in the original, if you're looking at a passage and it could mean one of two things, and you're not entirely sure which it means, what do you want as a reader? Do you want a translation that says, well, I'm going to translate it this way and take away that ambiguity, so my translation means this or the other? Or do you want a translation that leaves the ambiguity there so that you can see it and say, well, this is a difficult passage. I need to think about this and figure out what this means. Well, the easy way out is to say, I want a translation that makes all the decisions for me.
Footnote.
I think that's a really good option. You want a translation, if it does that, if it says this is the way we're going to translate it, you want a footnote that gives you the other option, that says it could mean the other. What I would prefer myself is one that leaves the ambiguity in there to begin with, and so I can see it and recognize it's a difficult text and wrestle with that issue myself. I don't want translators making the decisions for me because, you know, translators aren't responsible for my soul. I'm the one that needs to deal with those kinds of things on my own. So a couple of examples, 1 Thessalonians chapter 1 and verse 3, your work of faith, your labor of love, steadfastness of hope. Well, that first one in the NIV, your work produced by faith. That's one possible way of understanding it. The work could be the work that is produced by faith, or it could be that faith is the work itself that Paul is talking about in this context. Or perhaps Paul is being intentionally ambiguous because he wants you to think about all of the possibilities of what that could mean, rather than narrowing it down to just one of those. And if you're reading from the NIV in this verse, you read your work produced by faith, and you don't even realize there's another possibility of what this might mean, unless you know the text from a different translation as well. And again, I think that's the practical downside of this. I hesitate to say it's the danger of this. I don't want to be too dramatic. But the practical downside is you could read a passage like this and not even realize that you might be missing something. And so, again, for me, the translation you want is the one that preserves the ambiguity. The love of God, in 1 John chapter 2 and verse 5, whoever keeps his word in him, truly the love of God is perfected. Well, what is the love of God? Is it your love for God, or is it God's love for you? Or is maybe there another way of interpreting the love of God that could be understood in this passage? Well, again, in my opinion, I would prefer it to just say the love of God and let me wrestle with the particular interpretation of that rather than having a translation that makes the decisions for me. Shane?
Well, I think the example you brought up a minute ago about the 30 pieces of silver is a good example, too. I mean, where you'd have to go back and look at how much was 30 pieces of silver worth back then? I mean, if silver was extremely prevalent back then, if they had an abundance of it, 30 pieces of silver might not be worth as much. Or if it happened today, if back then it was very rare, and then today, well, you know, 30 years ago they discovered this huge mountain of silver, and so now silver's everywhere, and so if somebody puts, you know, a value to that, says, well, you know, 30 pieces of silver is like, you know, 30 pennies or, you know, whatever, it would lose something in the, you know, in the translation, where, you know, it's just, it's an amount of silver. You'd have to go back and look and see, well, what's, you know, what's the intrinsic value of it back in that day? What was it worth?
I had a translation at some point in my life, and I think it was an old King James that I read from when I was a kid, but I don't know for sure, that had a footnote that said that 30 pieces of silver was equivalent to like $19. And for a long time, that was just in my head. And at some point, it dawned on me, well, I don't know exactly when this Bible was printed. And I don't know when that footnote was added. I mean, even if the Bible was printed in like 1980 or whatever, that footnote could have been in there since 1920. What is $19 in the context of when that number was come up with, and how accurate is that anyway? That's the other thing. You know, whoever stuck that number in there, I'm just trusting that he knew what he was talking about. So there is all kinds of, you know, obstacles in dealing with that. Closely related to preserving ambiguity, perhaps a little bit of a bigger picture of the whole thing is to preserve the potential of the text, the interpretive exegetical potential of the text, which is what we were just saying. Don't let the translators make all of your interpretive decisions for you. So not just the ambiguous passages, but in general, that I think that rule applies as well. You want transparency to the original world of the Bible. And this goes back to what we were talking about a couple of weeks ago. You don't want them to remove the language and the figures of speech that are rooted in the biblical story. So whereas you could come up with a translation that means the same thing in terms of the idiom, if you lose something of the biblical backstory, that's not necessarily a good thing. So we were talking about 1 Peter when Peter talks about girding up the loins of your mind. Well, what does it mean to gird up the loins of your mind? Well, to gird up your loins was to prepare yourself for some kind of action. So it means to prepare yourself mentally for what he is talking about in that context. Well, you have translations that say something like that. Prepare yourself for action. Think clearly or something along those lines, some translations say. And in reality, that is what it means. But when you drop the girding up the loins, especially in the context of 1 Peter, you lose the Exodus imagery that Peter is rooting his argument in, and you lose something of the richness of that passage by losing the transparency to the original world of the Bible. One of the quotes we had up here a while ago from someone that argued for the more formal equivalence kind of perspective was that it opens up a whole new world to you if you'll take the time and effort to study those things. In addition to just seeing the bigger picture and picking up things like, you know, this Exodus imagery in 1 Peter 1, it also can be an enriching kind of experience to you personally to have to go back and work through those kinds of issues and think about them and understand them in their context. It can open up your eyes to completely different passages once you understand one of these kinds of cultural, original world situations. You can kind of see how that works out in other places as well. And so overall, you want something that I think to some degree makes you work in order to understand it. Even if it means you have to pick up a book every now and then and understand more about the culture or the language or whatever else is going on. And then also you want a translation that respects the styles of the biblical writers. Not every author of a biblical book wrote the same way. And again, we've talked about this before. This is one of those things that makes me think that inspiration is not just God taking over the person and turning him into some kind of automaton that churns out documents, but God allows them to keep their personality in the process, but ensures that the final product is what he wants. Now, don't ask me the mechanics of how that works specifically, but I think that's pretty clearly the case. And that's the reason why if, you know, you go over to Florida College and you take first-year Greek, when you get to second year Greek, what you start reading as a class is the book of John rather than the book of Luke. Because after you've had a 1 year of Greek, you wouldn't have a prayer of reading the book of Luke. A little bit here and there, perhaps, you know, with a lot of help. But John doesn't write as difficultly as Luke does. That's kosher, right, Katie? Difficultly. Luke's writing is harder to read. He's more sophisticated in how he writes than John is. And that makes sense. Luke is a physician, and he was as trained in whatever ways the physicians were trained back then. John's a fisherman. John's writing is going to be simpler. He's less educated. And you find the same thing with Peter and James, as opposed to the book of Hebrews. They write in different kinds of styles. Now, if you have a translation that takes all of that and churns it out as the same sounding kind of English, then you lose something in the process. There's something to be said for reading one of the less highbrow documents of the New Testament and seeing that it's less highbrow than, you know, the great treaties of Paul and Romans or something along those lines. And you don't want that taken away. Now, here's, you know, seven very simple, practical, easy to accomplish translation principles. Well, not really. Again, this is all against the backdrop of everything else we've talked about in the formal versus functional equivalence debate, or whether you want to try to find something that's mediating all of those other kinds of issues that we've talked about along the way. This is not an easy thing for translators to accomplish. And this is what I think are good translation principles that I think translators should strive for. But it's significantly much easier said than done to accomplish these kinds of things. So when to take this from what I think is good translation principle back to something that's more practical for you as you're evaluating Bible translations, I'd say there are four key ideas that you want to keep in mind when you are evaluating translations and choosing which one to read. First of all, the text itself. What text is the Bible you're using based on? You want something that is most accurate in terms of the underlying Greek and Hebrew texts, which also indicates, or would also mean, you want something that's, at least in the Old Testament, more modern than more ancient, because of the quantity of discoveries that have been made, particularly about the Hebrew language over the last few hundred years, that can change the meaning, the understanding. You think about what the Dead Sea Scrolls did in terms of the renewed respect for the Masoretic text, the Hebrew text of the Bible as opposed to the Greek translation of the Old Testament. You think about manuscripts of the New Testament that have been discovered over the years. To some degree, something that is more modern is better than something that is more ancient, just because of the amount of information that's known. Now, that's not to say, you know, go to the bookstore and find the newest Bible out. That probably wouldn't be a good thing, but to keep that in mind, again, in terms of the issue of the Textus Receptus that we talked about, and in my opinion, that's not the best Greek text, so you want something that's not rooted in that. So the text is important, loyalty is important as well, so the fidelity to conveying the meaning of the text, but also preserving the ambiguity, the style, the worldview, the word play of the original author is as much as possible. You want something that does all of that as well as it can, while at the same time being clear in English. If it's not understandable in your language while doing those other things, it's not a good translation. If it's perfectly understandable in English but not doing those other things, it's probably not a good translation. So again, you're stuck with the difficulty of what it is to be a translator. But you want something that as much as possible tries to accomplish these things, and then you want notes in your Bible. And by that, I don't necessarily mean notes that tell you what the Bible means. We'll talk about study notes in your Bible in just a second. You want notes that give you the information you need to make informed decisions. So like we were talking about a second ago, if the translators are working through this ambiguous passage and they think, okay, we're 95% sure the passage means this, and so we're going to translate it this way, still give the reader a footnote that has the other option. So you want a Bible that has those kinds of notes. And the best Bible, in as far as notes goes, and this is, I mean, pretty much unarguable, is a New English Translation. If you find one that's, you know, the full thing, there's like 61,000 translators' notes in the New English Translation that really give you the backdrop of you know, the verses they're translating. And even that doesn't answer every question that they had. But what they said is they wanted to give the reader a look over the translator's shoulder as they're reading as to what the translator was trying to accomplish. And it does a very good job of that. But most Bibles have some kind of notes that help you out with some of those things. A Bible with no notes, I think, is probably not your best choice at all. So is there a solution for all of this? Again, I think notes is important. Regardless of what the text says, put the alternative in the margin. That, again, gives the reader the opportunity to make an informed decision. And again, have multiple Bibles. We've talked about this before. I think this is something that is as significant as anything for you, practically speaking, in terms of what translation is best for me, what is the one that I should have? Well, the answer is don't have just one. Have a variety of translations that you read at different times for different purposes, especially if you're trying to study a text in detail, refer to more than one. And so, you might have your essentially literal translation that you like, your New American Standard, your English Standard Version, your New King James, whatever it is. You might have that for your study Bible. But at the same time, if you want a different perspective on something than you've had before, you could grab one of those dynamic equivalent, functional equivalent translations and read it fresh in one of those. And what you'll find very often is, I've never thought about this verse that way before. And at that point, you can think about it and you can either decide, well, that's really enlightening. I'm glad I read this. Or you think, well, I know why I never thought of it this way before. And, you know, that's something for you to work through, but it will invariably give you a fresh approach to the text because it sounds different from what you've always heard before when you read those verses. And that's one of those things that as you read those, you know, verses in the translation you've read a million times, is as good as it can be to know the Bible in the translation that you're used to using, you can interpret your own or read into that verse your own interpretation that is tied into those words. So you read it in a different translation, it gives you a fresh look at the text, and very often, if not every time, you'll find yourself thinking, oh, that's an interesting way of looking at this idea. I'll have to give that some more thought. So that's a very helpful use of the functional equivalent Bibles. And then grab a mediating Bible to have for some kind of balance. So you've got your New American Standard, which is a pretty literal kind of translation. On the other hand, you've got your New Living Translation that you read from to look at it a little bit differently. Find something in the middle as well that provides a little bit of balance on the spectrum. So your NIV, your NET, your Holman Christian Standard Bible, and you know, approach it from really all three perspectives, and that will give you the best possible look at the text. Well, I'll skip that chart. This one is probably not very visible to you, so I'll give you an idea of what it is. We've been talking about this translation continuum. That's what it's called on this chart, at least, where you've got a line, and, you know, not every literal translation is exactly the same. Not every functional translation is exactly the same. Really, you've got one on one end where you've got your interlinear here, so you've got the Greek text and corresponding English words above it, and you've got, well, you got the Message over here. That's probably a bad spot. We'll say the Living Bible here is the end. The Message, I think, is over there somewhere. So we'll say the Living Bible's at the other end of it, and everything else kind of falls in between somewhere along that spectrum. So according to this chart, and again, this chart wasn't inspired, but it'll give you an idea. The New American Standard's the second dot, the fourth dot's the English Standard, the King James is the sixth dot, there's the Holman Christian Standard, the NIV's here about the middle, New Living Translation's here, Contemporary English Version, Living Bible, Message. So again, that kind of gives you an idea of at least one person's thinking of seeing how these flow from more essentially literal to more paraphrase, if that's helpful for you. Yeah, Tom?
NIV fellows made this continuum, so it's no accident anybody's right smack in the middle.
Yeah, this
I would put it a little further to the right, but
okay.
And the NET's not only.
Yeah,
I would put probably close to the middle.
Okay. I missed the when I was going through these. That's the King James again. The New King James is right next to it. So, anyway. Any questions about any of this up to this point before we move along to something else? Yeah, Brother Winton?
An interesting thing. You find an old King James, it'll have the pronunciation. And you can that helps a lot when you starting out.
You know,
you pronounce it. You said Orion or Orion.
You know, I seem to remember the first Bible that I, well, not the first Bible I had, the first Bible that I remember having when I was old enough to be able to take care of a Bible was one of my dad's old Bibles. It was an old King James that I'm sure had, I remember having some of that pronunciation stuff in it, and that's interesting. Yeah, Charlie? English Standard, on this chart, it's right here. It's the fourth dot. So, again, I don't know how accurate this is. I mean, the guys that did this, like Tom said, they're the people. I've quoted from that book a couple times. I said they're NIV guys. So it's their perspective on this. They're more learned than I am. They're more closer to experts in translation than I am. So I would trust them over than just what I tell you. But I think Tom's right that their placement of the NIV and smack dab in the middle is probably a little suspect. All right, well, So, taking all of this and going to, again, very practical side of things in terms of choosing a translation, the first question to ask is, what do you want as a translation? Do you want a functional translation, or do you want a formal translation? And again, formal is more essentially literal. Functional is more paraphrase. I would say formal is what you want, maybe to mediating. My feeling is to read a mediating translation for a fresh perspective, and a formal translation for study. Maybe every now and then get a functional one down off the shelf, but for the most part, those stay on the shelf as far as I'm concerned. But functional translations are too dependent on the translators. Functional translations, you're reading their interpretation very often, more so than an informal translation. Now, the reality is all translations have to interpret somewhere. And all translations do it somewhere. The question is, how much interpretation do they do as opposed to how much translating do they do? And my feeling is to minimize it to only when it's absolutely necessary. And even, again, the mediating translations do that more than the formal translations do. So that's, again, kind of the way that I would lean. If you want the most literal, your New American Standard is about the most literal you're going to get. Except for where it's not. And that's one of those, and that's how all translations are, all formal translations. It's very literal, except for where it's not. And this is one of the things that I'll point out very often as a con of the New American Standard. And not because it does it more than other translations, but because it's so well known as a literal Bible that you don't expect it. And you don't expect it to be as egregious as it is sometimes when they do it. So even something like the New American Standard has its moments where it engages in interpreting the meaning and making that decision for you as a reader. So beware of that everywhere. And again, that's where it's important to read multiple translations. So if you can't sit down and read the Hebrew and the Greek, like the vast majority of us can't, you can realize, this might be one of those passages where I need to look at it a little bit in more depth. The ESV is also kind of literal. It's a little bit more readable than the NASB is. If you want something that's a little bit more readable in English, it has its own obstacles. One of the problems with the ESV at times is it seems to be more loyal to the way the text has always sounded, the words that have always been used, rather than translating it accurately at times. And it's not that way all the time, but every now and then I'll read something and I'll think, well, that's not the best way to translate that, but that's the way it's been translated since 1611, and so that's the word they chose to use there. At least that's how it appears to me. So it's a little bit more readable, but it's also an essentially literal translation. If you like the Textus Receptus, the New King James is probably what you want, unless you want the Old King James, but those are your two basic options for the Textus Receptus. The mediating translations, the NET is probably about the middle. It's more literal than the NIV is. It's harder to get in print because it has 61,000 notes. But if you have a tablet, you can get an NET pretty easily and have access to all of that. The Holman Christian is more literal than the NIV is. It's possibly suspect, and I don't want to say this the wrong way, because they had a translation committee filled with people from a variety of denominations, but Broadman and Holman Publisher is a subsidiary of the Southern Baptist Convention. So there's at least a red flag of possibly, the translation being under the thumb of a denomination. I don't really think that's the case, but, bear that in mind. I've not used it much. My experience with it, it's not been bad. It's obviously less formal equivalent, less essentially literal than what I'm used to, but it's from what I've read of it, it's pretty good. NIV is the most readable of all of them. It's also the most functional of all of them. So, Brother Winton?
You have to be careful about getting a translation translated by one man.
Yeah, if you have a translation that's done by one person, then you've got a problem. Because what you have is his opinions of what the text means. So anything that's done by a committee of translators is better. Anything that's done by a committee of translators from translators that are across the denominational spectrum is better, because they balance each other's pet doctrines out that way. So thank you for that. Well, practically speaking, what do you want in your Bible? How do you want your Bible to look in terms of layout and editions? And this is the kind of thing that's really not that big of a deal, but it's worth thinking about. You got study notes in some Bibles. Are study notes a good thing or a bad thing? I think that's something of what the answer is. The answer is yes. How about this? Are sermons a good thing or a bad thing? Cover your ears, Tom.
Mine are sick.
Yes. Tom's sermons are sick. Well, it depends on both of those points. It's someone's interpretation of what the Bible is. So it can be helpful. I mean, you can have a Bible with study notes, and those can be incredibly helpful for you at times, but they can also be misleading. Remember, if you have a Bible with study notes, that's not part of what the inspired authors wrote. That's as useful as a commentary and usually less useful than a good commentary. My opinion on study notes is if I want help in understanding the text beyond what I can come up with, then I'll go find, you know, a stack of commentaries and read a few of those that balance each other out rather than just reading what's printed in the Bible. Cross-references is the same. Cross-references can be helpful, but they can also be misleading. They can miss things very often. If you're looking for a concept and it just is referring to a single word that's used in this other passage, well, sometimes that word's used in a completely different context, and it's not talking about the same thing. Sometimes a directly related concept is in a passage that doesn't use that word, and you miss it completely. So that it can be helpful to use those cross-references, but they're not foolproof either. Maps, I think, are pretty obvious. You want maps in your Bible unless you've memorized the geography of the ancient Near East. Otherwise, maps are, you know, I can't imagine a time where maps would be unhelpful unless they have, you know, here's the outline of the Exodus and they, you know, take you through Africa and around, you know, through South Africa and back up. Other than that, I think, you know, maps would be helpful. So, Brother Winton?
Well, most Bibles may have a dozen, two dozen references, cross-references, mm-hmm. but you go to a lexicon, there may be 200.
Yeah, or a concordance, you'll have even more in those kinds of things as well. Paragraph text, I think, generally is more helpful than it's not. Again, this can be a debated kind of issue, and this is something that was added by translators, so this is not something that was in the original text. But generally speaking, I think the paragraph text do a pretty good job of indicating a line of thought. I think they were better at older translations that did this. Now, in our ADD generation, people think someone can't read a paragraph that's more than like five lines long, and so they break them up more, and you lose some of the train of thought in some of the more modern paragraphed readings. But generally, I think they're more helpful than they're not, but that's my opinion. Margins for note-taking? What do you think? Good or bad?
Good?
Yeah, I think it can be very helpful. You know, you hear someone preach a sermon and it enlightens you on a text in a way you've never been enlightened before, and you write all those things down and you remember them for the rest of your life. That can be very good. Is there a point at which it can be bad? What if what you wrote down was wrong and you remember that the rest of your life?
I've crossed out a few things.
Yeah. Exactly. And anyone who conscientiously takes notes in their Bible will say the same thing. I've crossed out a few things. That's what you have to do. You have to read it afresh every time you read it. Don't be guided by the notes you've taken in your margin. Try to read it fresh so that you're not bound by the interpretation you've already set on that verse. Well, I'll stop there. We've talked about the rest of the other things that I was going to talk about in terms of choosing a translation, which is, you know, spend time with more than one translation. You know, investigate your options and then don't get stuck on just one. Multiply your Bibles. So we'll end it there, and Tom will start next Sunday on a different subject. So thank you.